When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Across the Sky is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard in severe weather. Choose Weather Call.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Across the Sky, our national Lee Enterprises weather podcast. I'm Matt Hollander, based in Chicago, and I'm joined by my fellow meteorologists, Jill Martucci in Atlantic City, Sean Sublin in Richmond, and Kirsten Lang in Tulsa. With spring officially beginning this week, we're going to take some time to count down the top 10 things you should know about spring. We'll dive into the list in just a bit, but first, like we did for our episodes on the top 10 things to know about fall and the top 10 things to know about winter, guys, I want to start by getting your opinion on spring. Where does it rank in your season rankings? As I've mentioned before, for me, fall is my favorite season and winter is my least favorite season. That leaves spring and summer in the middle. Now, when I lived in Texas, I would have said spring was my second favorite season because summer is in Texas. Awful. Now that I'm in Chicago, summer's pretty nice. So I have to say summer is my second favorite season now, and spring is my third favorite season. You know, I like the temperatures in spring, very similar to those fall temperatures I like. But my problem is, unlike fall, you don't have as many quiet weather days. You get more severe storms in the spring than the fall. And as a meteorologist, that means more long work days, especially when you get a system that produces severe storms on the front end and snow on the back end. Fun times. Especially once I get to March, I'm so over snow and long, long Midwest winter. So I have these negative feelings associated with spring now, and I gotta say, I really don't like it as much. But is that just me? Guys, where does spring rank for you?
So spring, I have to say, is like fall, and there in the fact that you have the most comfortable temperatures, right? And I'm in this era of my life where I'm just looking for some comfort. Okay. So summer's too hot here in Tulsa. You have such swings. Winter gets a little chilly. So I like spring. I like spring like I like fall. Now fall gets me more excited. We've talked about this because you're going towards the holidays, and spring is the lead up to summer, which I dislike most, which we talked about. So that gives me a little anxiousness, but you know, we're starting to get blooming outside. There's some beautiful trees around here. I don't know all the names of them. I have a red bud. I know about that. But, you know, I think all of the color coming back after such a dull and sad and dreary winter usually is kind of a nice refresh. And so spring is going to be up there for me with fall. I like it the same. I just like the change. And you get some nice change during those two seasons, in my opinion.
All right. So caused a little bit of drama with the fall a couple months ago and my thoughts on fall and how it's last in my mind and all that stuff. Now, here we go. Spring. The short answer is spring for me is my second favorite season, but it could get down to third depending on how snowy my winter was. So if there was a lot of snow in the winter, I bump it down to three. Otherwise, it's two. This winter, we had some snow, but not a lot in New Jersey. So I'm going to say this is two. But there's a couple of different things going back and forth. One, March Madness starts this week. That's the kickoff to spring. I mean, days are getting longer. That's good, too. But a couple of things. At the Jersey Shore specifically, if you live along the coast, especially in New England, you're going to know what I'm talking about in the Northeast. It gets cold during the day. It could be 75 degrees in Philadelphia, and Atlantic City could be 52 degrees. Those things happen. Those are real things. So you have to take it with a grain of salt, but I live enough inland where I'm getting that warm. The other thing is May is my birthday. So that's a good thing. I'm spring birthday, so that's good. May 13th, usually we're talking about really breaking into summer by that point, although I've had a stretch of wet, rainy birthdays in a row. But overall, I would say The weather's warmer. I'm not allergic to the pollen anymore as much. We have March Madness starting. We have the longer days. It's number two for me most of the time. If it's a super snowy winter, I'm bumping it down to three.
See, I'm settled on three. I would have said two previously, but now the summers in Chicago are just too nice. I got to put summer number two, but fall will always be my number one. Sean, where do you stand on spring?
This is a tough one, but I will say second place because summers do get very hot and very humid here in Virginia. Fall is still my favorite, but spring is second favorite because while I do have the allergies, they're not debilitating. You know, a little bit of an antihistamine for a few weeks and I'm okay. So I'm fortunate that way. But the thing that gets me with spring is the excitement of renewal coming out of winter. I mean, I don't hate winter, but this excitement of seeing things bloom, more daylight. I mean, as I get older, I really appreciate the daylight. And by the way, before we get into this whole daylight saving time nonsense that people get all upset about, if I had to pick one, I'd stay on standard time. Because I also get up earlier than I used to, not like 2:30 in the morning stuff, but I like the daylight in the morning. It gets the old circadian rhythm going, right? So I don't want it to be dark at 7:30 in the morning. I want the sun to be up 6:30, 7.
Yeah, that's the thing. The weather in spring is definitely a little more exciting than the fall. But again, at the same time, can be talking about dangerous weather as well. But it is definitely, you know, in fall, you just have more quiet days where, you know, maybe it's just rain showers or thunderstorms, but less likely that they're going to be severe storms. And until you get into the later part of fall, you don't have to worry about snow. So it's just not quite as active. You still get good temperatures in fall, but not quite as active. But again, as from a meteorologist perspective, that's good and bad because we like talking about active weather. I mean, that's why we exist as meteorologists. If it was quiet weather days, we wouldn't have a job every day. But I just feel like sometimes it gets to be a little much in the spring. Sometimes it gets a little bit too busy because there's really no shortage of interesting weather to talk about. So that's what we're going to dive into after the break. It's our top 10 things to know about spring. No particular order to this list. These are just the 10 most important things we think you should know. And we'll bring them to you right after this.
Hey everyone, Across the Sky is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose Weather Call. Get precise, location-specific alerts via phone, text, or email. With over a decade of experience, Weather Call delivers pinpoint accuracy for your exact address, ensuring no surprises. Take charge and stay prepared when ominous skies loom. Explore the Weather Call difference today. Visit weathercallservices.com/Lee Enterprises and safeguard yourself, your business, or any school that matters to you. You can also find that link in our Across the Sky show notes, weathercallservices.com/Lee Enterprises.
And we're back on Across the Sky to kick off our list. We're going to talk about the timing of spring. I'm sure some of you are thinking, wait, didn't spring start already? Why are y'all doing this episode now? So, Sean, what can you tell us about the different ways we define spring?
Yeah, I know in the old days, spring was just that thing that happened when you had the equinox sometime in March, 19th, 20th, 21st, around that time. And, you know, that was the start of spring, the end, right? But when we do our record keeping in terms of when it is warmest, when it is coolest during the year, right, to make the record keeping a little easier, we just take the 3 months of the year where the temperatures are in the middle. In this case, it's going to be March, April, and May. And we call that meteorological spring. You know, the three hottest months are summer, June, July, August. Three coldest months are winter, December, January, February. So this is mostly about record keeping when we talk about meteorological spring or climatological spring, because those individual dates change because the orbit is not perfect around the sun and all these other little astronomical things. So respect to the astronomers who have brought us astronomical spring. That's what you still see on the calendars. But I do like meteorological spring a little bit better for the record-keeping purposes. One other quick thing, though, and I kind of knew this in the back of my head, but Joe taught me about this a couple years ago, is solar spring, which is the 3 months where the sun is in the middle. In other words, you've got the 3 months of the year where the sun is highest in the sky at noon, and the 3 months of the year where it's the lowest. So in between, you've got solar spring. Now, that again, that doesn't line up perfectly at all with the months of the year. But Joe, jump in real quick.
Yeah, it's actually early February to early May, yeah. Sean. So that's the, you know, in between of the longest quarter and the shortest quarter of the days. And I'll tell you what, we're recording this on Pi Day, March 14th. I was just on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, and I'm walking around. And mind you, air temp's about 60 or so. And I'm like, geez, feels a little hot out there with the sun. So firmly in solar spring.
That's the idea. Meteorological spring, astronomical spring, one that's on the calendar is the one that you brought up with. That's the astronomical spring. And then solar spring, just to make it more confusing. So you celebrate spring however you want and whenever you want. I'm not going to argue with you.
Yeah, so that's why you hear about spring has begun multiple times, because there are ways you can define it. But, you know, coming back to meteorological spring and it being the in-between temperature months between winter and summer, those in-between temperatures, not as hot as summer, not as cold as winter, well, that means it can still be cold in spring. And so the inevitable question we get as meteorologists is, when will it not be cold anymore? When is the warm weather here to stay? And the answer is, it depends, certainly year to year, but also depending on where you live in the country. So for our second thing you should know about spring, let's talk about the average last freeze, the last time it hits 32 degrees or below in the spring, because I think that's a temperature that just about everyone agrees is cold. Now, there are some places where winter really does end at the end of February. Florida, southern Louisiana, southern Texas, southern Arizona, southern and central California. It's pretty unusual for it to freeze after February here. In fact, there are plenty of years in southern Florida and southern California where it might not freeze at all. For most of the country, winter definitely wants to linger into spring. For central Texas, northern Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, you usually see your last freeze in March. Early March in the southern parts of those areas, late March to the north. Go a little farther north, North Carolina, Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, on over to Indiana, Illinois, southern Iowa, Missouri, eastern Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, northern Texas. Here you're talking about early or late April on average for your last time seeing 32 degrees or colder. Now, if you live even farther north, even in May, you're still not in the clear. Much of upstate New York and New England doesn't see their last freeze until early May. Same thing with southern Michigan, southern Wisconsin, northern Iowa, southern Minnesota, western Nebraska, South Dakota, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, northern Arizona, New Mexico, and freezing temperatures on Memorial Day. That can't be ruled out in northern New England, northern Michigan, northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Idaho, Utah. Yeah, average last freeze, not until late May. In fact, you get up in the mountains in those states, and you're talking about the average last freeze. Yes, average last freeze. It's not unusual in early or late June. Crazy. So yes, it depends. But if you're looking for one date, you may have heard of Mother's Day, mid-May. And for a lot of the country, that's true. You're usually safe from cold weather after Mother's Day, except in our coldest states. And I've got to mention climate change here, too, because over the last decade, our last freezes have been occurring earlier in the spring than normal, and that's a trend that's likely to continue. But, you know, as much as we're all happy to see freezing temperatures and snow go away, what comes after? Pollen, spring allergies. And that's the third thing you need to know about spring. You got to be prepared for the tree pollen to ramp up. And it's tree pollen we're going to focus on here because that's the one that gives people the most issues and also causes the biggest mess. As far as the peak of tree pollen season, it follows the same general trend as the last freeze date. You know, for the southwest and southeastern U.S., you usually see the peak in late March. For the Northwest, Central Plains, Ohio Valley, Mid-Atlantic, you typically see the highest tree pollen levels in late April. And for the Intermountain West, much of the Midwest and New England, the worst usually occurs in late May. Now, as far as the weather conditions that have an impact on pollen levels, the days you really want to watch out for in the spring are sunny, windy days. That's usually when the pollen count spikes, especially if you get several of those days in a row. And rain really is a good thing when it comes to pollen. Rainy day will definitely knock a lot of it out of the air. Of course, you probably aren't going to be spending a lot of time outside on a rainy day. So if you're an allergy sufferer, your best opportunity to enjoy time outdoors in the spring is simply going to be the day after a big rain, especially if light winds are in the forecast. Now, guys, fortunately, tree pollen doesn't give me too much trouble. Maybe a little bit of an itchy nose, but that's usually about it. But what about y'all? How does pollen treat you?
So I used to be bad as a kid. I had the nebulizer sitting at home on the kitchen table while I'm just breathing in and out of this stuff into my lungs. But I don't know. When I got to like maybe out of college, it wasn't as bad. And now it's like, I mean, I do take Claritin, but as soon as I do that, like I'm fine. So it's gotten better with age, and I hope that continues.
I've just been kind of one of those lucky ones where I really have never been too really affected by allergies. And even growing up in South Texas, it was pretty bad with pollen. I mean, it's bad everywhere. Every place is different, but you know, pollen was just running rampant in South Texas. And it never really bothered me. I think when I moved to Oklahoma, maybe with the winds kind of drumming stuff up, it got to me a little bit more. And so for a while there, I would medicate. But, you know, now things are pretty good. Maybe a day or two here or there, just depending on how the winds kick up here across the plains.
Yeah, much the same. It's not too bad for me with tree pollen. Actually, grass pollen is worse for me. So as we get into late May and early June, when the grasses really pollinate, that's when I have to hit my antihistamines for a few weeks. But more fortunately, I do not have a massive problem with it. So
yeah, it definitely helps if you're not impacted by the pollen so much. For me, it's more just the mess it makes on your car, you know. And being in Chicago, I do have to say there's certain parts of the country that get pollen worse. And some of the worst I ever dealt with, Sean, was in Richmond. When I lived there for a year, I could not believe the amount of pollen that came out of those trees. Not as much in Chicago. So certain parts of the country, it's also something that we could talk about, do have it worse. That is a thing. There are certain places that deal with more tree pollen than others.
The pine pollen in the Southeast is something to see if you haven't seen it. It can be just, you wash your car, you come back literally an hour or two later, like, why did I wash my car? We haven't gotten to that part of the season just yet. Right now, it's still other kinds of trees, but it's coming. Oh, it's coming.
I remember many a birthday in the middle of May where, like, I'm just so excited, and then the day comes, I just have this pulsing headache right above, like, my right eyebrow for all day long, and I'm trying to be happy, and I want to be happy, but the allergies are getting at you. So it's always bittersweet. It was bittersweet for me on my birthday sometimes with those allergies.
Yeah, we're wishing everyone an easy pollen season this year. And remember, if you're an allergy sufferer, again, best opportunity the day after a big rain. I know you don't want to be out on the rainy day, but the day after those pollen levels, after a good steady rain, those pollen levels will be lower. So that's going to be a good day for you to go outside. But moving on to our number four thing you should know about spring. You know, we often talk about all the wet weather we see, and you get expressions like April showers bring May flowers. But what about when you don't get April showers? What if drought starts to creep back in? Well, then you can have a pretty active spring fire season. Joe, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, lack of April showers means May fires for especially a lot of the Northeast and the Midwest here. You know, in May or April, whatever have you, during the spring, let's say. Yeah, you still have that dry air. The Gulf of Mexico isn't producing those humid, soupy days yet. So you have the dry air. The sun is pretty strong, especially as you get towards May. And you have lower humidities, typically. And that's just all favorable for the spread of wildfires. You know, again, mainly in the Northeast and the Midwest, although it can extend down to the South, too, at times. And you know, the one thing you want to watch out for, be on the lookout for, is when the National Weather Service issues these red flag warnings. So, you know, we'll talk about it. You probably see it on your phone app
And red flag, it's interesting because it's one of the rare weather alerts issued by the Weather Service where the name doesn't necessarily match up with, hey, this is what's happening. But when you see a red flag warning, it means that the combination of warm temps, low humidity, and stronger winds combined to produce an increased risk of fire danger and wildfire danger. So what do? You want to make sure you limit your burning. You're not having the barbecue outside. You're making sure, if you're smoking a cigar or a cigarette, it's fully put out. Don't throw any matches out of a moving vehicle. And you can see these fires anywhere. Again, I'm just going to use New Jersey here, but I've seen it on the New Jersey Turnpike, brush fires on the side of the major interstate, Interstate 95. You see them in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, but anywhere in the Northeast in those forested areas, can have that. Now, what happens a lot of these states is in March, sometimes February, even into April too, you get prescribed burning by the forest fire services in your state. And what that's doing is it's helping to mitigate any future wildfires that come. So the forest fire service will burn some of the fuel. Fuel is another name for branches and twigs and grasses that are all dried out on the ground. They'll burn that out and they'll get rid of that just in case a wildfire sparks, whether it's by lightning or by humans, it won't travel as far because those dried tree branches that were in that pile 10 feet down from you, they're not there anymore. So that fire can't spread there. So the Forest Fire Service usually does a very good job at that, especially in New Jersey. There's a lot of controlled or prescribed burning this time of the year. And, it's a good maintenance plan for the forest. I know burning forests intentionally sounds a little counterintuitive, but it really is a benefit just in case we get those wildfires as we go into the spring and sometimes even the early summer.
Yeah, I always thought the red flag warning might not be the best term for that because I think it does confuse people. Like, what the heck? What do I have to be worried about a red flag for? That's not what we're talking about. Really, think of it as fire weather warning. And so I think we're kind of transitioning to maybe using that term a little bit because red flag warning does tend to confuse people. But if you see the red flag warning, that's still technically the term that's used. Think fire weather warning. Just be careful and avoid burning anything outside. And as much as we do want you to be prepared for fire season, we can't talk about spring and not talk about the fifth thing you need to know, severe weather season. Yes, when spring rolls around, thunderstorm activity really starts to ramp up. But what's the difference between a regular thunderstorm and a severe thunderstorm? Kirsten, what can you tell us?
Well, we're recording this on Thursday, and I'm telling you, I'm sitting here just on the edge of a severe thunderstorm here in Tulsa. And so what does that mean? It just means that the storm has the possibility of producing hail of at least 1 inch in diameter or greater, winds within the storm that could gust in excess of 57.558 miles per hour, or of course a tornado associated with it. Anything under that criteria, it's not considered a severe storm. Of course, it can be a strong storm and still have, smaller penny-sized or nickel-sized hail, but it's not until that hail reaches or has the potential of reaching towards an inch or greater. So those are the main criteria for becoming a severe thunderstorm. And as I mentioned, Oklahoma is lit up like a Christmas tree this afternoon with those storms rolling through.
Yeah, sometimes I hear people say that was a severe thunderstorm just because it had a whole lot of lightning and a bunch of thunder and it was kind of scary to go through. But if it doesn't have quarter-size hail, if it doesn't have those wind gusts up to 58 miles per hour, if it didn't produce tornado, no, technically it's not a severe thunderstorm. That was a strong thunderstorm. So lightning is not one of the criteria. There's not a certain amount of lightning that makes a storm severe. That usually, I think, is what throws people off. There's a whole lot of lightning. People think that was a severe storm. It's like, no, lightning is not one of the criteria. If you didn't get one of those other things, not technically a severe thunderstorm. But it's those three criteria: damaging wind, hail, tornadoes. That's what we want to focus on when we come back. We're going to take a quick break, but we've still got five more things you need to know about spring. So don't go anywhere. More Across the Sky coming up.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Across the Sky podcast. We release new episodes every Monday on our Lee News websites, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, YouTube. As they say, wherever you get your podcast. And if you like what you hear, like us, rate us, review us, share us with a friend. It really does help us out, and we sure appreciate it. We're continuing our countdown of the top things to know about spring, and at number six, it's one of the severe weather hazards we alluded to before the break, damaging wind. Now, of course, this can happen in isolated spots and individual storms, but what we really have to watch out for are widespread damaging wind events. Joe, what can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so we call them a derecho, D-E-R-E-C-H-O. It is Spanish for straight ahead, as our buddy Sean Sublett just told us in the break, so thank you, Sean. But a derecho is actually a technical classification, and what I mean by that is the National Weather Service says anytime you have a wind damage swath, straight line wind damage, different than tornadoes, of more than 240 miles long, you have a derecho. So you're talking about, you know, in your big states, something that's kind of sweeping across the states, or maybe it's going across multiple states. So a derecho can really happen at any time of the day, and sometimes they strengthen overnight. We had one here in New Jersey in 2012 that just got the southern part of the state, and some people would say that that was worse damage than what they had during Sandy a few months later, but it's a long-lasting area of thunderstorms that bring straight-line wind damage, and typically those winds are over 58 miles an hour. Now, there are some parts of the country that see more derechos than others, similar to other kinds of severe weather. The hot spot for derechos is northeastern Oklahoma into northwestern Arkansas and like southwestern Missouri, so like that triangle point, not too far away from Kearson and Tulsa, where we have four derechos every 3 years on average. We are talking about the derecho area generally being east of the Rocky Mountains, going all the way to the coast. The exceptions are Florida and then far northern New England. In the case of Florida, you just can't really sustain those kind of long-lasting thunderstorms. A lot of the thunderstorms are the sea breeze front kind of thunderstorms. And then once you get far enough north, you just don't have enough juice or unstable air in the atmosphere to carry them. So derechos, they are not to be messed around with. Even though it's not a tornado, they can bring the same kind of damage as a tornado. And that's true for any straight line winds, Matt.
The weakest tornadoes, yeah, can produce the exact same winds as a very strong straight line wind event. So the damage can be very similar, and that's why the National Weather Service has to go out there and figure out, well, wait a minute, was this just straight line winds or was it actually a tornado? And based on how the damage looks, if all the things have fallen over in the same direction, straight line winds, but if they're lying in different directions, especially it's like a grove of trees and the trees are all lying in different directions, then it was probably a tornado. But before we talk about tornadoes, let's talk about the seventh thing you should know about spring: hail. Now, besides tornadoes, I do think this is the hazard that makes people the most nervous, because the last thing anyone wants is a bunch of dents on their cars, cracked windows, roof damage. Yeah, I can feel the insurance folks wincing as I'm saying it.
You know, when you're out on, you know, a nice afternoon and you look ahead and you can see really tall clouds building, right? Most of the time those clouds are building tall like that because they are some sort of thunderstorm, right? Whether it be just a strong one, severe one, just a run-of-the-mill. But what I'm getting at here is when you have that vertical extent, what happens is that inside that thunderstorm, you will get these strong updrafts that occur. And these updrafts are just winds that are forcing up air from the surface to the highest levels of the clouds. And so what they'll do is they'll carry water droplets up there past a freezing level then at that point up in the atmosphere. And then it turns those water droplets, of course, into ice crystals. Those ice crystals then start bouncing into each other. They grow larger and larger depending on how strong that updraft is and how long they stay up there. That depends on how big the hail will be whenever it falls. So again, you've got this updraft. It's pulling up these water droplets. They're turning into ice. They're colliding with each other. They're growing, becoming bigger. And then at some point, of course, gravity makes these suckers fall. And so then they come down. And as I mentioned, it kind of depends on how strong that updraft is. That will depend on how big the hailstone is, if that makes sense. So they are directly correlated. But that's what causes, or that's what, that's how hail forms, I guess I should say. And you know, hail sizes were, you know, we're looking at some of the smaller ones, as I was saying earlier. It has to be an inch in diameter for it to be considered severe. So some of the smaller hail would be like a pea sized hail. That would be a quarter of an inch in diameter. And then the ones, the hail that's, you know, that is pretty rare, but I mean, I've never seen this and I hope I never see this. So the largest one would be a grapefruit size, and that would be 4.5 inches. I mean, could you imagine? That's just like, that's huge. That does damage. Let me tell you, if that hits you, oh.
I don't know if you could even survive if a grapefruit size hail hits you.
I mean, those would really be some odds for it to hit you anyways. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's kind
that
of
is true.
Like, you were, A, you got to be, I don't know, caught in a situation where you can't get out of, but like, let's hope that you wouldn't just run out into a severe thunderstorm where you're seeing that kind of hail anyways. You know, you probably want to get.
I do know. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. What's the largest hail you've seen, like been a part of?
No, I don't know. I wouldn't say any bigger than like golf ball.
That's still pretty big.
I've been pretty, but it wasn't like, it was like here and there, right? I've been pretty lucky since I've lived in Oklahoma, and there really haven't been, knock on wood, as I'm sitting here with severe thunderstorms around us, there haven't really been any, you know, large hailstones that have come down around me, at least, since I've lived here. Surrounding areas, of course, but not here.
But here's one for y'all. The record size hailstone in the U.S., Vivian, South Dakota, 8 inches in diameter. 8 inches. Can you you can look up the pictures online. It's incredible. But an 8-inch hailstone. Imagine the damage that thing is going to do if that hits your car or your roof or, yeah, your head. I don't think you might not have a head if that hits your head. An 8-inch hailstone. That is the record, if you're wondering. Hopefully you don't see any of that.
I just had hail damage on my car in September in New Jersey, of all places. We don't really get hail. But there I was stuck in the core of a thunderstorm at Rutgers University in traffic, and the hail just kept coming and coming. I said, well, you're just kind of sunk because you knew it was hitting your car, and it did. And $500 deductible later, thankfully it wasn't that much, but then probably a couple thousand more on the insurance's end. I got all the spots taken out of my car, but that was a bummer. And it took weeks. So if you can put your car in a garage, always a good idea. Or don't drive when there's a hail thunderstorm coming your way.
You know, I have friends that here in Oklahoma, if they you know, think that there's some storms coming by that may be producing hail, and if they don't have a garage, they will drive to parking garages like at the hospital nearby or like a mall, something like that, to protect their cars.
Yeah, you should do, Kirsten. You should build a garage on your property and then charge people.
I don't have that much land.
next house.
Maybe the next house.
That does sound like quite the moneymaker, have to say.
There's always a way to make money in this world.
There you go.
Well, as bad as hail can be, we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about the most infamous kind of spring weather, tornadoes. And Sean, for our eighth thing to know about spring, let's talk about the timing of tornadoes. Now, obviously, they can occur at any time, but what time of the day are they most likely, and what time of the year?
Yeah, I mean, most likely, they come in the late afternoon or early evening, because that's when the atmosphere has kind of reached its most unstable, and that's when most energy is available to produce the storms that will in turn produce tornadoes. So it's that late afternoon, early evening that it's most favored. But as you said, they can happen at any time because they don't necessarily have to happen in those classic supercell thunderstorms, right? You could have the smaller tornadoes that occur near cold fronts or what we'll call a quasi-linear convective system, basically a squall line that's a little bit not a perfect line. It's kind of broken and busted up. So you could have these at any time, but that is the time of day to be most concerned. And in that vein, the time of year that they're most likely is the spring for similar reasons. The atmosphere is still very cold, 5, 10, 15, 20,000 feet up, but we're getting into March, April, early May. The sun is higher in the sky, so it can heat the ground a lot more easily than it does in the fall. So that's going to enhance the instability of the atmosphere, furthering it toward the development of thunderstorms, which indeed go on to produce tornadoes. So again, they can happen any time of year, but those are the two times that they are most favored, in the early to middle part of spring and the latter part of the afternoon and to early evening. But one of the things that's it's worth mentioning is that as we brought up earlier in this segment, as the climate warms, we're starting to see more of these tornadoes that don't go with that classic diurnal cycle of thunderstorms, especially in the southeastern part of the United States, where we have more forested areas and there is a more concentration of mobile homes. So the vulnerability to tornadoes is actually going up in the southeastern United States, because frankly, it's a lot harder to see those things in the forest versus out on the plains of Oklahoma and Kansas.
Yeah, that shifting tornado alley that we've talked about before and how we're seeing them occur farther to the east. I mean, they've always occurred in the eastern U.S., but maybe at a higher frequency than they used to. And yeah, watching out for those nighttime tornadoes, they just do tend to be the deadliest, because when people can't see that tornado coming from a mile down the road, it definitely, and when people don't see it and it just sneaks up, especially if you've been sleeping overnight, those do tend to be the most deadly. But also talking about rating tornadoes, that's what we're going to talk about for our number nine thing you need to know about spring. The Enhanced Fujita Scale, or the EF scale for short. Now, you might be wondering what the word enhanced is all about. Well, it did used to just be the Fujita scale, the F scale. It was developed by Dr. Ted Fujita in the late 1960s and early 1970s as a way to estimate the wind speed of tornadoes based on the damage they left behind. But by the late 90s and early 2000s, meteorologists and wind engineers started to notice some problems with the F scale. For one, studies found that it didn't take as much wind as originally thought to cause significant damage, especially to poorly constructed buildings and mobile homes. And then there was the problem of rating tornadoes that didn't hit any buildings. What if a tornado only damages a cornfield and some trees? The F scale didn't consider damage to plants. So with that in mind, in 2007, the scale was redone to make it more accurate and was renamed as the Enhanced Fujita Scale. So what do the ratings mean? Well, for a tornado that causes EF0 damage, that means it produced wind gusts ranging from 65 to 85 miles per hour. Really the same kind of winds you can see in any severe thunderstorm, as Joe mentioned. For an EF1 tornado, you're talking about wind gusts 86 to 110 miles per hour. And the vast majority of tornadoes are weaker ones like this. 81% of all tornadoes are rated EF0 or EF1. It's once you get to EF2 that the damage really starts to ramp up. EF2 tornadoes produce wind gusts from 111 to 135 miles per hour and account for 14% of all tornadoes. EF3, now you're talking about 136 to 165 miles per hour. And for EF4, wind gusts 166 to 200 miles per hour. But only 5% of all tornadoes are EF3 or EF4. And finally, this brings us to the top of the scale, an EF5 tornado. Any tornado that produces wind gusts over 200 miles per hour will be rated an EF5, but the good thing is these are exceedingly rare. Only 0.1, yes, that's 0.1, not 1, 0.1% of all tornadoes are rated EF5. In fact, and before I say it, I'm going to knock on wood, there hasn't been an EF5 tornado in the United States since the Moore, Oklahoma tornado on May 20th, 2013. Let's hope the drought continues. And finally, this brings us to the 10th and final thing to know about spring, tornado safety. And actually, this is going to be more than 10 things to know about spring, because we each have a tornado safety tip for you. I'll go first. And one of the biggest myths I continue to see get spread about tornadoes is that in order to reduce the damage to your home, you should go around and open all the windows in your house to help equalize the pressure. No.
No. No.
Don't waste your time opening windows. Yes, there is a pressure change associated with tornadoes, but that's not what causes the damage. It's the wind. And opening your windows is just going to guarantee that all the stuff being carried by the tornado is going to get blown into your home. It will not reduce the damage to your home. It will not keep you any safer. Do not waste time opening windows when a tornado warning is issued. Get to your safe place as soon as possible. Interior room, lowest floor of your home. So that's one myth busted. Joe, do you have another one for us?
I do have another one for us here. So this one is about where to shelter for a tornado. You might see there's been a viral video in the past. Sometimes movies talk about this, about going under an underpass, a road underpass, as a good place to shelter from a tornado. That is not a good place to be. You know, if you are driving, it's tough when the tornado's near you. You don't want to try to outrun the tornado because roads are in straight lines and tornadoes can go any which way. So you are confined to the roadway in which you're in. So that's not good. Your best case scenario, if you are truly in a situation where a tornado is coming at you and you're in a car, pull over, get into a low-lying ditch, and hide for cover there. There's, of course, it's way safer to be inside. But if you need to, that is the best place to be. You don't want to be in an underpass because that tornado can crumble the underpass and then you're underneath it and can get crushed. So if you're in a car, don't outrun the tornado. Make sure you can get into a low-lying ditch. I will say the chances of a tornado actually going over your car while you're driving are very slim. But if you're caught in that situation, that's what you want to do. Don't go to the underpass to seek shelter. And of course, I should say too, depending on where you are, I mean, if you can pull over and run into a building or a structure that can provide some safety real quick, obviously you want to do that. But I'm thinking if you're in the plains, not much around you, you're on the highway here, you see the tornado, that's where you're going to want to go in a last ditch effort, no pun intended.
Okay, so let me follow up on that because I have another theory as to how this whole going under an overpass got started. And this goes back to the late 80s and early 90s. There was a video that, had it been out today, we'd say went viral, but that wasn't a thing in the late 80s and early 90s. This was just on CNN, and the people were driving along and said, "Hey, get up under the girders." And that was a video that was replayed over and over again for weeks about people taking shelter beneath an overpass or the girders of the overpass, I believe in Kansas, in the late 80s or early 90s, which I think is how this whole going under the overpass idea got started. Because, you know, I'm 19 or 20 when that thing happens, and I never, ever remember people saying, "Yeah, go under the overpass," just like they did on that. No. No. So my guess is that that's how it got started. But a lot of times people ask us, "Well, what if I'm here? Well, what if I'm there? Well, what if I'm in this situation? Well, what if I'm in that situation?" Just remember these two most important things: as low to the ground as possible, right? Because you're trying to avoid things flying around in the sky, all right? Because most people aren't going to be sucked up by tornadoes and taken to Oz. I mean, it can happen, but you're more likely going to get hit upside the head with bricks or a 2x4 versus being pulled up by a tornado. So that's why you want to get low. And the second thing, put as many walls between you and the outside as possible, because it's a lot harder for bricks to go through three walls versus two. So those are the two most important rules to follow: as low to the ground as possible, put as many things between you and the outside as possible. And yeah, if you can go into a basement, that's what you want to do. But don't overthink it. And of course, you know, mobile homes are just obviously very dangerous in these situations. So you try to tell people if there's a tornado watch, find some place to go in the 1 or 2 hours before it can get bad, because you don't want to be in a mobile home. Tornado warnings issued, it's dark, you don't be driving around outside, you have maybe 10 minutes of warning, you can't see the thing coming, and then you are in trouble. So that's a tough situation for sure. But those are the two things I tell people the most when they're worried about, what about this? What about that? Low to the ground as possible, as many things between you and the outside as possible.
I was going to say that's an important point for folks that live in an apartment. There are a lot of folks, especially here in Chicago, where I'm on the 18th floor, not a good place to be if a tornado is coming. So even if you're on, and that's an exaggerating example, our apartments are second and third floor, but you don't, it's a strange thing because you feel like my apartment is home. Home is safe. But actually, if you're not on the first floor, it's not the safest place to be. So that's why you want to make friends with somebody who is in the first floor. Maybe your apartment complex that does have a basement, mine actually does, that's where I would go. Maybe you have a storm shelter. Some apartment complexes, especially in more severe weather areas, that would be a place to go. But at the very least, making sure that maybe if you don't know, have any friends who live on the first floor of an apartment building, another alternative I say is go to the leasing office, because there's a good chance there's a leasing office at your apartment complex. It's probably on the first floor, so that might be a good place to go for folks in apartment situations.
Yeah, and I think my biggest safety tip is just awareness. I think a lot of times people maybe are unaware of what's happening until it's happening, right? It's supposed to be a beautiful day, because that's typically what happens, unless it's some sort of nighttime tornado. It usually happens, of course, on a nice sunny day as it's all starting to heat up and get rampant, right? And you're thinking, oh, this is nice. You can kind of feel it, at least in Oklahoma. You'll start to feel like the moisture in the air and stuff. And so you can kind of feel it. But it's like, you know, if you're not paying attention, that's the first tip I would give people. It's just be weather aware. Just, you know, have whatever it is that you use to inform you on weather. Have that, you know, around. Have alerts that go off on your phone, weather radio at your house, any of those types of things that will let you know what's going on, so that you're not caught in the middle of it just somewhere random, like on a golf field, heaven forbid, or, you know, something like that. You know, you want to make sure that you know what's coming.
Yeah, we've said that one before. Stay weather aware. Check the forecast every day, so then you're not caught off guard. You're not surprised. If you know in the back of your mind there might be the chance for tornadoes, then you have an idea of like, okay, what will I do? Where am I going to be today? And then you have an idea of where you could go if there's a tornado. So planning ahead, keeping an eye on the forecast absolutely is going to help. All right, well, there you have it. The top 10 things plus 3 extra to know about spring. Got any more spring or severe weather questions? Send them to us. Shoot us an email at podcasts@lee.net or leave us a voicemail at 609-272-7099. You can find both of those in the show notes, and we'll be happy to answer any questions you've got for us. And finally, before we wrap up, we're starting a new segment on Across the Sky today, and we're calling it Across My Sky. Joe, can you explain this one a little more for folks?
So because we are all across the country, literally across the sky, we are going to do a little bit for you at the end of our podcast, talking about the one thing we noticed that might just be unique to our region here. So, you know, Matt's in the Midwest, I'm in the Northeast, Sean's in the Southeast, Kirsten's in the Plains, Kirsten and Matt are both from Texas. I'm sure there's no shortage of things to talk about here. So I'm going to start, because we are airing this episode the day after St. Patrick's Day. And the one thing, and I remember talking to you guys about this, and then I spoke with some other newsrooms in our Lee Enterprises systems, is that I think it's only a thing in like the New York, Philadelphia area where St. Patrick's Day parades take place like way before St. Patrick's Day. Like most of our St. Patrick's Day parades are done, and we didn't even, you know, and I'm recording this right before St. Patrick's Day. They're done before we get to St. Patrick's Day weekend itself. It's going on March 1st, March 2nd, and everything. I just thought that was always normal being here. And then I talked with you guys about this earlier in the week. I talked with our other local newsrooms, and they're like, yeah, if they even have anything, right? Some places I'm seeing in the West don't do much St. Patrick's Day. But, you know, it looks like they're all happening on the weekend itself. But here in the Northeast, like, we just want it to be one long party, I guess, for like a couple of weeks at a time. It's like those shamrock shakes from McDonald's. They keep coming out earlier and earlier. I mean, it's going to be the, you know, New Year's Day, and they're going to start coming out with the green shamrock shake at some point. So that's what I have across my sky here in the Northeast. And it reminded me I still need to go to McDonald's because I haven't gotten one yet.
I have not, gotten a shamrock shake either, but I can stick with the St. Patrick's theme here, being in Chicago. St. Patrick's Day is a big thing in Chicago. And for folks who've never come to Chicago for St. Patrick's Day, it is a sight to see because they really do dye the river green. It is bright green. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen the pictures online, but it is no joke. That is real. It is super bright green. And people wonder, like, well, how long does it last? How long is it like that? Actually, it's only for a few days. Fortunately, it's not any toxic chemical that's going into the river and killing the fish. It is bio-friendly. It does not harm the fish life in the river. And it only lasts. I mean, they do it in the morning. The Saturday, if you're wondering about the timing, it's always the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day. So if St. Patrick's Day is on a Wednesday, it's going to be the Saturday before. In this case, it's going to be the day before St. Patrick's Day. But that's when you need to be in Chicago. Because, again, if you want to see that bright green river, it's that Saturday before St. Patrick's Day. And so if it's later in the week, St. Patrick's Day, the river might not be bright green anymore. It will be this year because it does last a few days, but it doesn't even last a full week. So keep that in mind. If you want to see the bright green river, the best time is going to be the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day.
We got married on St. Patrick's Day. So I like that holiday.
There you go.
Anniversary, me and my husband. I don't really have anything St. Patty's Day themed, I guess. And I'm going to break the mold here because it's not really in my region, but I have been just almost, in our terms, I guess, obsessed with what's going on in Colorado. Because I just think this snowstorm is just cool, and I wish I was there. I'm sure if I was there, I wouldn't think it was as cool because you're, like, snowed in with over a foot of snow. But, I mean, the pictures out of it are just crazy. They're just getting mounds and mounds of snow. Earlier, again, remember this is previously recorded, but earlier we were seeing some of these totals just up into the foothills of a little over 2 feet of snow just in the past, 24, less than 24 hours. So that's what's been on my mind, I think, as far as weather-related stuff's going. I wish I was there.
Ski season's alive and well in Colorado.
Yeah. Man, people are heading up for spring break next week. They have got some, what are they called? Fresh pow-pow. They got it.
Fresh. That's a new one for me. I didn't hear that one.
The pow-pow?
Yeah, the pow-pow.
They got the pow-pow.
All right. So we're here in Richmond. It's all about St. Patrick's Day as well, but our celebration is also very, very compressed. It's all coming into this weekend. We've got a big festival up at historic Church Hill. It's called Church Hill because that's the hill where St. John's Church is, and you might remember from your history books where Patrick Henry said, "Give me liberty or give me death." It was at that church on that hill, thus the term Church Hill. But the big Irish festival is both days this weekend on Church Hill here in Richmond. And there's a smaller, I shouldn't say small, there's another kind of party going on called Shamrock the Block over in another kind of more hip area of town.
Yeah, because you can definitely get some bad weather on St. Patrick's Day. You can get severe storms. I think we talked about in our top 10 things to know about fall, how Halloween is the holiday you have to watch out for, and the wild weather you can see on Halloween. Well, I think St. Patrick's Day and Easter too. I mean, Easter, it's harder to say because Easter, the date of Easter changes so much. But really, as we talked about throughout the spring, very volatile weather, especially March and April, like Colorado, a great example. You can still get some big snows. You're not in the clear until after Mother's Day. That's when things quiet down a little bit more. At least you don't have to worry about snow so much. Well, I like this across my sky. I think now we can say we cover everything across the sky. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the Across the Sky podcast. On behalf of Lee Enterprises and my fellow meteorologists, Sean Sublett in Richmond, Kirsten Lang in Tulsa, and Joe Martucci in Atlantic City, I'm Matt Hollander in Chicago. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great first week of spring, and we'll catch you here again real soon.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.